It's time to talk about the outdoors in South Alabama. Hunting, fishing, and getting outside along the Great Gulf Coast. It's time to take it outside with FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. With reports, stories, how-to information, and Dr. Bill's Marine Forecast. Here's Sean Sullivan and Mike Ward.
And away we go, FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Glad to have y'all along. And at some point during the show, my friend Captain Mike Ward will show up and be part of the program as well. But we get started now. A lot to do on today's show. Definitely some fishing to talk about and some snapper discussion too. Even after the conversation we had last week about the projection of the quota for this season, we'll continue with that conversation in a little bit. But like this transitional month of August, it's kind of perfect because there's a critter out there that some people say they're hunting for, some people say they're fishing for. So it's the perfect transition. That's alligators as gator season getting ready to get rolling this month here in the state of Alabama. And joining us to talk alligators when we do, we talk to supervising wildlife biologist with Alabama Division of Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries from right here in beautiful District 5, Chris Nix, and the crowd goes wild. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Sean. Glad to be with you, buddy.
Hey, good to have you on as well. So, you know, we discussed this earlier in the year and people going through, registering for the gator season and doing all that. Well, now the winners have been picked and it's their chance to hunt. So talk to me. What's the status of populations like down here in Southwest Alabama? What's the preseason rollout for the hunts? What are you expecting?
You know, Sean, We do surveys every year and, looking at the populations down here and in other areas of the state, where the vast majority of the alligators reside. But, everything is looking stable to increasing on our population. The surveys that we do, the interesting part of it is we are hearing more about alligators over the last couple of years, more than we ever have before. I don't know if the alligator population is increasing, but I definitely think that the human population is increasing down here in our area.
Yes, and more chances for interaction with those alligators. Yeah, I was an alternate this year for the gator hunt, so I went through and watched the videos and did all that. It was interesting to me. Out of the different districts, and we can talk about that, the zones for the gator season, that area around Eufaula over there was one that had some a little different regulation, right? And why was that?
Correct. Yeah. So, several years back, we started that zone, and Sean, don't quote me on this. I'm not in the office at the moment, but I want to say that was like back in around 2008. 2009 when we started that zone. And we monitor these populations every year, but we did start seeing a decrease over there, and the decrease that we were seeing is in recruitment of juvenile alligators. So we made some changes, decreased the tag numbers, and put a slot limit basically on the alligators over there to try to protect that female portion of the population. And it seems like it has helped, and we're going to continue to do that until we start seeing a change. When we set these numbers for each zone, first and foremost is the population. So we want to look at that first and then, set the number of tags accordingly to that.
Just joining us, talking to Chris Nix, supervising wildlife biologist with Alabama Division of Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries, talking alligators. Okay, so, but the flip side of that, I wonder, I think we've talked about this in the past, but the nature of, let's talk Southwest zone, let's talk about coastal zone. People want to get a big alligator, man, right? I mean, that's what people are looking for, a big gator. And the bigger the gator, am I right in saying the better chance it's going to be a male?
100%.
Okay.
Yeah. So, a female alligator, the largest that I've ever seen or heard of is around 10.5 foot. So the majority of the breeding females are, I'm going to say, between 8 and 9 foot in length. When we go out to hunt alligators, we're usually looking for something a little bit bigger than that. So, a very small percentage of the female portion is usually harvested during the alligator hunt.
And that's, I mean, and by that nature, I mean, when y'all started it, I remember going, well, if they're wanting to reduce population, then that probably won't work. But it has shown itself to be super resilient, right? I mean, because by nature, we're trying to get those bigger alligators, and we're not really denting the female population here that much, or are we?
Sure. No, we're not. And, you know, reducing the population has never really been a goal of ours. You know, and offering this opportunity in an alligator hunt, the alligator population in Alabama is stable and usually increasing in most areas. So it's not that we're wanting to reduce the population. It's just that the population can sustain a regulated hunt like we're trying to offer.
Yeah, you're just taking the overage out of that, you know, whatever it would be. I mean, there is some similarity, right, to manage them like you would a whitetail population. I mean, can you say that?
Some similarities, yes, but it's a lot different. So if you mess up an alligator population, it takes a lot longer for that population to rebound. You know, if you mess up a deer population, you know, usually that you can fix that within 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Alligators are a lot different, so that's why we're very meticulous in how we allow the number of tags allowed each year. So I know a lot of people get frustrated with that, but you know, like I said, the population is first and foremost, and then we allow the number of tags that you know that particular population can sustain.
And one of the things about the limited number of tags is something that actually came up the other day with somebody, because I said, yeah, I got alternate, but I didn't get drawn, but my points will build. And that person said, what are you talking about? And I said, my points. And they were pretty shocked. And they said, well, I'm going to put in, you know, not this year, but there's a reason to put in every year. I mean, can you explain that to why I'm mentioning points? What am I talking about?
Man, I would love to talk about that, Sean, because I get so many phone calls about it. So, you know, several years ago, well, let me back up. When we started the hunt back in 06, it has made so many transitions since then. And I feel like we have got a system now to where it's fair for everyone. So when you put in for an alligator tag, you're allowed to apply for each zone one time. And then we started a preference point system back in 2014, which allowed you to build preference points for each zone. So those points are built zone specific.
So they're not building overall.
Lose your points.
Okay.
One is if you do not register for a particular zone in consecutive years. Mm-hmm. Say if you skip a year, you're going to go back to zero. The other way to lose your points is going to be if you were to draw a tag, you were selected, and you accept that tag and you get it, then you go back to zero. So what we're trying to do is allow people that have consistently put in each year for a particular zone to build those preference points so their odds of, you know, drawing a tag are higher. And then the way that those points are built, and a lot of people don't know this, is each year that you put in, you take the number of previous years that you've applied for a particular zone, and you cube that number. So, like, if you have applied for the Southwest zone for 2 years prior to this year, 2 cubed would be 2 times 2 is 4. It would be 8, and then you would get one additional point for this year, so you would have 9 points. You know, looking at the points this year, I mean, there's people up in the 400s and 500s.
Woo!
And you know, it's not that they're
for all zones or for an individual zone, Chris, or
yes.
Okay, in an individual zone.
Individual zone. So all those points are built zone specific. So it's not that we're guaranteeing them a tag, but the odds of them drawing are way higher.
Mm-hmm.
So we just want to make it as fair of a system as we possibly can.
Yeah, and people might understand this. I mean, with the idea out west and doing draws, you know, that you build these points and you get a better chance, not a guaranteed, but a better chance. By the way, I'm going to get cocky. I think probably when I see mine this next year, I make it to triple digits finally. So, y'all look at me, see what a winner looks like.
You still mentioned, won't get wrong.
And Mike Ward's in studio now. Something you mentioned, there's a little nuance to it. I think it bears a question here. If somebody is drawn, okay, if somebody is drawn, Chris, and they put in, you know, in June or whatever, and they put in a drawing and they're drawn, and all of a sudden they realize, oh my gosh, work, I got to go out of the country, or, you know, something major's happened, and they don't, they're drawn, but they don't accept that tag. What happens with those people?
Well, then they maintain their preference points.
Okay. They turn it back in?
The only way that they can lose their preference points is when they log in to My Hunt and they say, yes, I want this tag, and then I mail them the tag. But prior to that, if they say, I deny this tag, and a lot of people do that, Sean. You know, they'll put in, even knowing that they can't hunt that particular year, they'll still put in, you know, and it costs $22, you know, for an alligator tag, which is unheard of, you know, comparing to other states. They'll do that just to protect their preference points.
Yeah, because if they don't, they're going to lose their points, all the points, right?
100%.
Yeah.
Yep.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of strange, but you take the risk of getting drawn, but if you get drawn, it's okay. If you don't accept the license, you're still in the mix.
Absolutely. Yep.
Well, that works out.
Yeah. So that, interesting too, that you build your preference points specific for the zone. So somebody can, I could have 200 in the, you know, I got 200 in the southwest zone, and I might have 50 or something in the coastal, right?
100%. Yeah. And then you, like, say if you was to draw in the southwest zone, then those points would go back to zero, but your west central zone points that you did not draw in would maintain your current status.
So, I mean, it's its own entity by zone. So even, so you could, while you're not going to get another, you know, you're going to go to the back of the line because you drew a coastal zone. That doesn't mean you're not in play the next year for that west central zone.
Absolutely.
That's pretty cool. That's a reason, because people, I mean, we all look at it and say,
That live down here in our area, you know, we've got basically three zones within driving distance, you know, the west central zone, the southwest zone, and the coastal zone. So if you put in for all three zones every year, then there's a chance that you could continue to, you know, a high chance that you could continue to draw a tag each year for each zone, and always have an opportunity to go alligator.
I think you just opened some eyes on that.
So you could say if you're putting in the draw, you could actually get two tags or even three.
But he's saying that if you – okay, go ahead.
Yeah, but you can't get one tag. If you had you were trying to get drawn out of three different places, you can't get but one tag a year, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So say, like, if Sean was to put in for – the coastal zone, the west central zone, and the southwest zone.
Which is exactly what I do.
Two of those. He could only accept one.
One, okay. Yeah, we'll make sure of that. Yeah.
But then
the
I keep my points.
You keep your points and others.
He would maintain his points.
Yes.
So, I mean, and that's good. There's a reason for people to, you know, put in for, you know, those three zones. Yeah, like you said, I mean, and there's other zones in the state, but those three, like you said, are kind of, you know, within driving distance, an area you can scout and all that around. I know there's other zones, but I don't know about those other areas. I know about these down here.
Correct.
So, yeah, you can be building points, so conceivably you could get drawn back-to-back years, just the luck of the draw or the selection.
Yeah, yeah. And it's the same way over in the eastern part of the state. You know, a lot of those guys would put in for Lake Eufaula and the southeast zone, and then just hopefully that they will draw, you know, in back-to-back years.
So what is the number one zone that people apply for? Do you know?
The most popular zone still is going to be the southwest zone, and that's just due to population. But when you look at available habitat for alligators, the biggest portion of prime habitat for alligators is it's within the Southwest zone. So from a number standpoint, that's definitely the most popular zone.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, just my, this is anecdotal experience, there's some studs and some big gators in the coastal zone, but they're, it's more limited. You know, you think about areas around the bay. We got the bay in the middle. Not that an alligator doesn't cross the bay, but the majority of that's not in play. Where when I'm in the delta, when I'm in the marsh or going up the river,
they're everywhere.
There's a lot more, yeah. I guess, right. Chris, sometimes more consistent gator habitat.
Sean, with people that live in this area, and they can definitely relate to what I'm fixing to say, there was a reason for that coastal zone to be created. And the biggest majority of the human population that is moving in this area is south of I-10.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the waterways there are, heavily populated with people. So we get a large amount of our nuisance alligator complaints south of I-10.
Mm-hmm.
I would much rather for an alligator hunter to be able to go down and capitalize on that animal rather than our department having to deal with it. So I'm trying to offer more tags down there to allow for that purpose rather than us having to deal with it.
And it makes sense. I mean, it's a win-win then.
Yes. It's a win-win for both parties, but you have to treat it completely different. Because those alligators act a lot different
mm-hmm.
living around a human population, more so than alligators in the Delta do. When you get up in the middle of the Delta, you may not see anybody all night long.
Right.
There is no people out there. So, but the alligators, they build their habits based on that, just like we do.
You preach. They're cagey in the coastal zone. Just joining us, talking to Chris Nix with Alabama Department of Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries, upcoming gator season. This is information so I'm not telling the people that have been drawn because they had to take the course and they know this, but maybe for people listening to understand this part, and I'm thinking about for coastal zone, about some of the rules too, though. I mean, you can't, there are some rules of where you can be hunting. I mean, with private property and all those kind of issues, along a waterway, like some of the dead end rivers around here.
Sure. And Sean, we have regulations, as far as like dispatching firearms within a certain distance of a public roadway or an mm-hmm. occupied dwelling. But then there's also municipal regulations, as far as being able to dispatch a firearm within city limits.
Right.
But that's up to the hunter to be able to, that's their responsibility to research before they go hunting. I help them out and I talk to them every day prior to the hunt. But that's something that you have to, to pay attention to before you go hunting, in those heavier populated areas.
Yeah. And there's so many different municipalities that we could be talking about in that coastal zone. Before we wrap up, too, for people who don't know some of the changes there, too, there's no culling, right? Explain what culling in gator hunting is.
Yeah, so in the beginning, we had a problem with people catching alligators just to be catching alligators. We all deal with social media now, and everybody wants the attention. as a department, we want to look at this opportunity to be able to harvest an alligator, not to post a Facebook post or an Instagram post. And that was happening quite a bit. So when you harvest or when you capture an alligator and you bring it boatside and it is of legal length, then that is your alligator, period.
Upgrade.
Every zone, legal length alligator would be anything, except for in Lake Eufaula, and we have the 8-foot limit.
In other words, you bring it alongside, you snag it, you bought it.
Exactly. You know, it's very similar to deer hunting.
Yeah.
You know, once you pull the trigger,
it's yours.
You put your scope on the spike and you pull the trigger, then that's your deer.
Yeah.
And that's one of your three for the year.
I can just see. I can just see me. There's a 12-footer out there, and I throw the hook out there, and I gaff him. I get him up there, and that 12-footer, I snagged that little one that was beside him. It was about 4 foot.
Only you, Mike.
Yeah.
Only you.
Well, that happened to me. For sure.
That's exciting, though. So tell folks too, if they see all those folks leaving at night along the causeway or other regions around the state, they're going to be doing that for a couple weekends.
Yep, it's going to start this coming up Thursday on the 11th. So, we're looking forward to it. It's a popular time for all of our hunters, and can't wait for it to get here. And I can assure you, we can't wait for it to leave once it comes.
Because he has to stay up all night.
It's a busy time for us.
Yeah, y'all don't get to sleep. I can't wait to talk about it afterwards and get some results and see how folks did this year. Chris, as always, we appreciate your time coming on and explaining all this good stuff to us.
Sean, I enjoyed it, buddy.
There
appreciate
he is.
It, Chris.
There's Chris Nix. And, you talk alligators in our area, that man's a font of information.
Yeah.
Speaking of the night the gator hunt starts, Turkey Federation having a banquet on that night, too. We'll talk about that when we get back. Plus, I got to go keep Red Snapper on a Wednesday this last week. Wednesday.
I want to hear about it.
And I was keeping, and I kept fish undersized.
How about that?
But I had Marine Resources listening to me. I may be in trouble until I tell them what I was doing. Coming right back. All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward, glad to have y'all along. And a big thank you to Chris Nix, supervising wildlife biologist, District 5. And this is the start. We've had gator season in this area down here longer than anywhere else. So he's been doing the gator stuff longer than the rest of the guys with the state that are fanned out around the state.
Didn't he say 2006, I think, since 2004?
Yeah.
So,
and by the way, that point thing, the reason I talked about that is most of y'all listening did not get drawn. Okay, just the odds of it. Most of y'all did not get drawn. But I've watched I was an alternate this year. Means I had enough points that I made the alternate pool. And then they end up filling the tags that didn't need it. But I keep all my points. And his point about, even if you didn't put in for Eufaula in the southeast zone, if you put in for the three down here, you're building points. So even if you get drawn for one of the zones and you go to the back of the line on that zone, because you get drawn, take the tag, kill the gator, whatever. Even if you don't, you go to the back of the line on that.
On that two, particular
that
zone.
The other two zones, you're still in the heat and you're still building points. And so it's different for people who haven't gone out west or dealt with the point system. But that's the way we do it. And I think it's the fairest way to allocate those tags.
It is. It's great for a state because you're
remember
putting,
how it was?
You're putting $22 a year in it.
Right, well, they were getting a lot more.
It's good for everybody.
But it's not a money run because they were getting a lot more when it was the open Wild Wild West. And, I told you, I got out of it at that point because early on, it was just how many entries you could buy.
That's right.
And there were people there buying $5,000, $10,000 worth of entries.
Yeah.
I don't need to kill an alligator that much. Yeah. I just went, well.
But me and you were putting in like
five.
Yeah,
I put in like five entries.
I think that's what I did too when it first got started.
Yeah,
and wasn't no chance.
And then there are people putting. I mean, there is a chance, but statistically it's less. But people are putting in all that money. I said, to heck with it. Well, we weren't the only ones. They read the room and how people were reacting. That people were just coming in buying, spending that kind of money, which was putting it out of reach for a lot of folks.
Sure.
So they said, okay, how are we going to do this? And they do it like the Western draws. This is the best fair system. So it's worth every year, put in. And, even if you go, well, I can't really this year, I can't do it because we're doing whatever. You get drawn, you can not accept the tag, you don't lose your points, you stay in the mix.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm hoping for Kansas, right? Because I didn't get drawn this year. So
yeah.
I'm building points
for
Kansas. I know you did. That's why I pointed it out, Mike. I didn't get drawn for anything. I didn't get drawn in Colorado. I mean, there's some leftover tags, but I wasn't real interested. I didn't get drawn to Colorado. I put in usually always Utah and Colorado, also New Mexico, which is not points. It's just random draw at Arizona, which at 97, when I have enough points to maybe be able to get like a mule deer hunt there, somebody will roll me up the side of the mountain in my wheelchair there and let me go shoot one of those big mule deer. I have to come back a second time to be able to get enough points to get an elk tag there. But I work at it.
I try.
There is a – even in the Western draws, you can put in your – there is luck of the draw. There is some randomness where you can get – some people are drawn with very few. And for that reason, I throw money in a fireplace and put in for – Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep, desert bighorn sheep, mountain goat, moose. I put in for those, knowing that I probably will never draw.
Right.
But it doesn't break my heart either, because that money goes to their wildlife and conservation departments of those states. And I do hunt those states, like Colorado, for mule deer and elk. And so I appreciate that money going back to, you know, what I like to do. Sure. If I ever, you know, get lucky enough to draw sheep tag, it'll be great, but it may not happen.
By the time you do all this, after about 15, 20 years and you haven't got drawn, you could have got a fine guided trip somewhere.
Not really. No. So if you want to buy your way in, we're going to talk, well, we'll have to probably next segment talk the snapper, because I want to say this. If you want to pay your way into like a desert bighorn sheep hunt.
Right.
Look at a place like, I think it's called Tiburon Island off of Mexico, where they got this population that you can pay to go.
Right.
Right? I think last time I checked the hunt, before like trophy fees and all that stuff, I think you're at 80-something thousand.
Ooh. I was talking about like mule deer out in New Mexico. Or elk hunt.
Yeah, those things I can get. I could draw. So what I've done with the mule deer hunting, just because I knew this year would be tough, and my buddy, I go mule deer hunting out there.
Yeah.
And elk hunting, I can draw those certain areas. There's certain areas that are harder than others. But I tell you what I learned is if you'll hunt, I'm not going to tell you all the areas, but I'm putting in for areas that I can, in Colorado, I can legitimately draw a pretty decent tag every 3 years or so. And because I'm putting in for the same cluster of areas, I might not be in the exact same area, I might be in a unit right next to it or whatever. Over time, we've learned the area from my first trip back then to now. And so if you know an area, okay, if you know an area, let's say we're going to judge these areas from 0 to 10 on a scale. 10 is this one where it's just all the trophy mule deer bucks come from, it's this great spot to go. Usually those places also are easier. They have a lot more public land, and it's less hiking. It's easier because people want to draw something that they can stroll their fat butts around. So you have two things. You have trophy potential out there, and you also have ease of access. Okay, so those two things drive how sought after a tag is. I can put in for what you might call the lesser units, but I can draw it every 3 years or every 2 years, And guess what? I learned the area. And now I'm not going in. Now, if you lived out there and you could scout everything and you lived in Colorado, I live in Mobile, Alabama.
Yeah.
So my scouting's on the ground as we get there and season opens. So over the years here, I've been going to the same general areas. Now, next time I get drawn, and I'm just better and better, I go, okay, we saw bucks when the snow was here. We saw the bucks in this draw. I can go there immediately and start glassing.
Sure.
So I have a better chance of killing a deer and a good deer. Because that time of walking around and riding around an area and trying to figure out where the heck you are, I don't have it. I know some areas. Yeah. So even though that other area has, it might have better odds for, has tougher odds for drawing because of ease of access and the amount of, big deer that have come from it. A lot of deer there.
Yeah.
But you look at the success percentages, sometimes they're down. And some people aren't taking the big trophies because they get there, they draw it, they're coming from New York or Alabama or somewhere, and they're like, you spend the first 4 days trying to figure out. Now, if you're going to get a guide or outfitter, a different story.
Yeah.
You get drawn, you get an outfitter, they do all the scouting. But I do that stuff. We all do it ourselves.
When you get there.
Well, yeah. I study maps and satellites and satellite imagery and all that stuff, big time before I go. But yeah, each year I go back to the same area. I'm a better hunter in those areas, and I know where I can go. Yeah, okay, let's start here. Snow falls here. Let's do this, and it's made it better.
Sure.
So I don't know. It's just a different way to look at it. And I was thinking about on the sheep thing too. I saw this story pop up this last week. Speaking of sheep, because people always told me, hey, Sean, here's where you could buy your way into it. forget about the lower 48 sheep. You know, don't worry about bighorn or desert bighorn. Go doll sheep hunting because you can buy your way in, and it's, you know, you can do it. Even though this doesn't sound cheap, you can do it for $12,000 to $15,000. Yeah. Which, if my wife ever heard that, I'd be have to find a new place to live.
Yeah.
But this week, the federal government has closed doll sheep hunting in Alaska's Central Brooks Range, which is one of the big areas people go to hunt doll sheep. A lot of outfitters out there said earlier this week, the Federal Subsistence Board voted unanimously to close more federal public lands in Alaska, this time for doll sheep hunters. The decision, called WSA 22-02, took many hunters by surprise, submitted for consideration early this year by the Western Interior Alaska Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. And it goes on to say here, it says, Western Interior Alaska Subsistence Regional Advisory Council requests doll sheep hunting on federal public lands in Unit 24A and Unit 26B, west of the, I can't pronounce it, Russian name, river, will be closed for all users during the 2022 through 2024 wildlife cycle. And there have been, like you can tell they're referencing, there have been other closures already in Alaska for different species and for out-of-state hunters. But yeah, it's a big deal because that's one of those two areas were pretty darn popular for outfitters and people from lower 48 going up there to hunt.
Did they give a reason?
Yeah, it's they said, okay, there's a population decline, but they go on and say population declines, people that are pushing back on this, there is a population decline. They say it's not due to hunting, and relatively low harvest in the area wouldn't impede the sheep's population recovery. The archery-only corridor they also have provides easy access for hunters, but success rates with archery equipment are extremely low. Typically fewer than 5 rams are killed in the archery-only area each year. Predator control measures were also brought up during the telephone meeting. They said heavy predation by wolves in recent years, but makes no mention of requesting protection measures for the sheep population, aside from eliminating hunter harvest, which is minimal, as they argue, in the archery-only area. And, you know, you're only shooting. I mean, they tightly regulate this, whether you're talking about dolls or down here with desert bighorn or Rocky Mountain bighorn or stone sheep or something. You're only shooting old rams. I mean, yeah. I don't know an area where you're shooting anything that's younger than, I think, 5.
Right.
And sometimes not. And by 9, doll sheep, a doll ram won't make it through his 9th winter. I mean, that's just – so you're shooting ones that will end up just dying anyway.
Right.
Most of the time. So, I don't know. I just thought I'd bring that up as we talked about the sheep thing. It's probably relevant to about 12 people out there, but I thought I'd bring it up and add it to the mix.
You know, they bring the wolves back, and that creates a problem, too.
It does. I'm somebody who has a foot in both worlds. Grizzlies, I have an issue with. Wolves, yes. Do they reduce, at first, wildlife population? Sure. They're part of the environment. They do some good out there. You know, the first thing they kill a whole bunch of? Coyotes.
Yeah.
You watch coyote populations where wolves have moved back in the West drop by 90%.
Yeah.
They kill a bunch of them. But yeah, it does. It makes it harder. Now, up in Alaska, the problem is the wolves are doing their part. They're saying the hunter harvest is minimal, but they're still blocking the hunters out of that area. I don't know. We'll talk about fishing when we get back.
Yep.
Some no-cull snapper. And how about this? On a Wednesday? Forget about it. All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward. Glad to have you all along on this Saturday. So Mike and I talking during the news break there and just had ranged into a conversation about grizzlies in Montana and them coming to a kill out there and the problems they're having out there because grizzlies have been recovered. State was supposed to take back over the management, which would mean hunting for the grizzlies. The antis out there filed lawsuit after lawsuit, just dragging it out in the courts. More stories from out there and Wyoming of people getting killed and mauled by grizzlies this year. But the issue is, people are saying out west they're shooting elk or whatever, and that grizzly, who can smell the best hunting dog you've ever had, ain't nothing compared to a grizzly bear's nose.
Right.
And they can smell that blood and that kill at distance, and they sometimes beat the hunters to the kill. And you have to back off the kill and leave it, or the danger is walking there not seeing the bear and something worse happening. But you said it was like sharks and porpoises or dolphins following
up to a spot
in the Gulf. Yeah, they go to it. So I go on this trip on Wednesday, So I've gotten invited to do this before, but finally they twisted my arm hard enough. I've always wanted to go, but it's like, hey, I can't be off work, this and that. A science trip that I could bring my daughter on. Yeah. And, you know, I think I told this on the air on the midday show. We're like Beverly Hillbillies because I've been on, over the years, some. My daughter's never been on a charter boat or a boat with air conditioning or like an inside in her life. So we're on there going, wow, look at this. I said, honey,
she liked that, didn't she?
Like, it's got a bathroom and air conditioning and TV.
Had to get one of these.
Yeah. So we went out with Skipper Theory on the Escape. And it was good to visit with Skipper. But went out there. And so we're on this research trip with Dr. Sean Powers, you know, chair of University of South Alabama Marine Sciences and at Dolphin Island Sea Lab. And so it's a research trip where they're doing, you fish, but you fish with certain tackle for a certain amount of time. They're doing research on this. Plus, they did the ROV, the camera on the bottom to look at the fish. And we did, on the way out, we stopped in somewhere, you probably guessed, stopped and caught some ling somewhere on the way out.
Yeah.
And then we went out and we could keep amberjack. We could keep everything because of science trip. We keep amberjack. We didn't catch any triggers, but we caught some amberjack. And you could get some we didn't catch triggers, but you keep snapper. But you fish on the snapper part, you fish for a certain amount of time, certain tackle, and you keep every fish. So can you imagine the frustration for the dolphins when they come rolling up and, you know, here comes a 12-inch snapper up or a 14. You know, they're thinking, okay. And now you throw them back and we eat them.
Yep.
Not on the science trip. You keep every one of them. I mean, we kept every fish, and this is what they do because they're trying to – they're comparing year to year, month to month on these different sites on average catch and all those kind of things. So there's a reason to do this. So we're keeping small fish. You should have seen the dolphins swimming around going, hey.
Where's mine? Yeah.
Hey. Yeah, almost I was joking saying, don't you know that dolphin's going, that's undersized.
Yeah.
You're keeping – I know you're keeping
and
undersized.
That's smart enough to know that too.
Yeah, I'm going to report you to Alabama Marine Resources. Y'all are fishing on a Wednesday and you're keeping undersized fish. And I'm putting some of the videos up this coming week when I get time on our Outdoors Facebook page of them doing the measuring and weights and tagging how they do these fish and, you know, tag the ones we killed, the snapper. Plus, we tagged some amberjack with live tags and put them back in. But it was really cool. So, yeah, big thank you. And Haley and Crystal. Crystal, who runs the ROV, the underwater camera, so good at it and so cool seeing all this. And a lot of fun. Get out there and just get after them. Yeah, I messed up the first one. I got myself in trouble with Dr. Powers just being a creature of habit. First fish I brought up was like 12 or something like that. And I grabbed the fish, unhooked the hook, and I'm dropping it back in. He's like, what are you doing? I was like, it's under – oh, gosh. He said, you can't do that. I said, okay.
Yeah.
It just takes a second to get used to – having a fish that size and putting it in the box. But, hey, some nice little fillets.
Yeah.
Very tasty.
So tell me this. What did you see on the bottom? What with the ROV?
We saw on the spots we looked, we saw no triggers on that one. Snapper, Almaco Jacks, Amberjack, and I think that one had – they said they saw more. I saw four lionfish. But they're, you know, what's interesting, too, is that research they've done on lionfish, they say, hey, lionfish have peaked and on their way back down because I said, oh, gosh, look at those lionfish. They said, yeah, they're down 80% in their surveys.
That's big.
That's big. 80%.
Yeah.
And I know that, you know, people have been spearfishing them and doing all that, but they said that's part of it. They don't know whether they've just filled all the spaces in the environment and finally the other fish figured out how to beat them or what has happened. You know, some people say there's some disease they're getting because these aren't their native waters and something.
Yeah.
But they said it's an 80% reduction. And they do grid stuff. They don't just put their thumb in there and go, oh, they're down 80%. They check the same wrecks in the same way and do these things. 80% reduction in lionfish population. So that's the good news.
It is. So what did they think about the snapper situation?
Right now it's just ongoing research they're doing. You know, I mean, we're looking at – and I'll tell you right now, the places we fished, I think the deepest we fished, maybe 110, you know, something like that. Something like maybe 115, not deep.
Is it private or public spots they were fishing?
So we did – a combination, but the majority were private.
Okay.
And because they're the ones that they want to go back to try to keep it right.
Yeah.
And try to keep some things the same.
But they don't know if anybody's fishing it.
No, they don't know. Yeah. I mean, Lord knows, nothing's private anymore.
That's right.
Things are, they're just not public.
Yeah.
Right? People go, oh, is this your private spot, Sean? I said, no, but it's not
public.
But that
really skews things up, though, when you don't know that, you know, maybe somebody's fishing it every week.
Right.
So you go back and check it, you know, a month or 2 months later, and more to fish. It's just no fish here. Well, you know, what happened? Well, it could be somebody's fishing it every week.
It is.
You don't know.
It's interesting, though, like Dr. Powers has talked about before, not all the fish were biting all the time. Like, they were biting when we were there.
Yeah.
But you look at, and there's a lot of fish, they're just doing other stuff. I mean, they got the camera down there, and you're thinking, okay, they're all going to go to where these baits are dropping. Yeah, some do.
Yeah.
And some got other stuff going on.
Yeah, they just don't care.
Yeah. Like, yeah. They didn't see it, they didn't smell it, they're looking at something else. Because you're thinking, because here's this camera looking, they're all going to go over
and
here.
There's your bait over here, and uh-huh. There's snapper swimming the other way.
Yeah. You're like, wait, it's a good learning experience for us to see that underwater footage. Because I just always had this image, snapper fishing my whole life, that every snapper on the wreck was racing to get that bait. No, some are.
Yeah.
And we caught, you know, I think we kept, you know, a triple digit number of fish.
Any big ones?
No. And that's what's interesting. So I don't know that we had. Now, we're fishing certain tackle, and that's part of the thing, too.
Okay.
Because I was like, hey, let's get some light line and knocker rig. They said, nope. They got to fish it the same way every time.
Yeah.
So using like sow rigs and chicken rigs and those kind of things. So
we need to talk more about this. Yeah. This is interesting.
Coming right back. Yeah. So I maybe out of all the fish, and I don't want to screw up. Dr. Powers them have the research on it, but or all the stats, but maybe five or six that were legal, that were 16 inch or above.
That ain't good.
On those spots. So, coming right back. Right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors, and we'll straighten out a lot of the specifics on the research because you got to get Dr. Sean Powers back on the show with us, talking some snapper. But yeah, so.
Give an overall, the whole summer or something report.
But yeah, the ones we kept were, it was weird, like I said. I mean, it was science trip, so no culling. You kept every one, you know. And so some of them were 15 inches, some were 12, you know. Like I said, a few were probably a little bigger. But you catch them. And you and I talked during the break. You got to catch them certain ways, too. Like, it's like you want to go, well, can I use this tackle? And then, no. You use... So they do it the same way every time to try to balance out.
Using a double rig.
Dropper rigs.
You typically not going to catch your big fish that way anyway.
Correct. Little pieces of squid.
Yeah.
You know, it was that kind of rig. So that's what we did. A lot of fun, though. Big thank you to the whole crew with South Alabama Marine Sciences and the Sea Lab for having us out there. Had a great time. And like I said, we were like the Beverly Hillbillies, my daughter and I, because it's been a long time for me and never for her. You know, boats with air conditioning, we don't, you know. Not used to that. So, and thanks to Skipper Theory and the folks with the Escape, great crew, and the deckhands on there, Clint and Chad, just great guys, because we had a pile of kids.
Yeah.
That's the thing. We had, we had 9 or 10 girls on there fishing.
Any of them get sick?
Nobody got, no. God, beautiful day. Beautiful day. I mean, there's rain early, but I mean, it laid out.
Well, who cares if it rains?
That's kind of what I said.
Just go inside. Wait for it to stop and go back fishing.
It was nice.
Yeah.
It was really, really nice.
So when you stick the cameras down and y'all catching the, 14, 16 inch snapper or whatever, did you see some snapper down there that were,
I saw
15, 20 pounds?
I didn't see any 20 pounds. But and you kind of get an idea because they got this laser that comes out the front of the ROV they can shoot. That's like, I don't know, it's 10 inches or whatever. So it shoots out so you can go, okay, if that's 10, then this fish is that long. You know, you can make. I didn't see any great big ones.
Huh.
So on that spot, we could have gone to other spots and seen them, but and they might have been just off camera, to the left or right or above, but that's what we saw.
So you just put the camera down one time or?
Yeah, just one time on that one spot. The other spots we didn't. And we just fished them, just by their chart of how many we fished for, see, like 10 minutes or something like that, and then ring a bell, and then you had to pull them up. But it was cool. It's something different, something I'd never done, and watch them do how they measure and weigh each fish and number them and all that. And then you end up keeping the heads and the guts and all that for their research. But the beauty of it is the fillets we get. So
and the smaller the better for me.
Man, I'm going to feel weird cooking them up tonight, but I've got some, like, look like a super big brim filet snapper. I'm ready to go. It's what I call it, a snapper veal. Is what I'm gonna have. So
tell me this: y'all caught amberjack. So how did you catch amberjack on the double drop rig?
No, you could on the amberjack thing. We use big hardtails.
Okay,
went to a different spot.
Okay.
And it was like, we're going there for amberjack.
Okay.
Because that, and that's the thing, too, how they do this, because I was like, okay, well, they're catching amberjack. I'm like, no, you can't catch, you know, we're doing amberjack here. So, yeah. I mean, it's there's a reason for what they do. It's still fishing and fun, but there's a reason. Caught some decent, I'd say, just guessing, looking at them, biggest amberjack's probably 30.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. 30 and change.
Well, right. Bigger than that, I don't care about fooling with them anyway.
It was fun, too, because it was like I said, we had, I think, 9 young ladies there, you know, my daughter and kids she goes to school with.
Yeah.
And not a one of them's over 130 pounds. The child, and watching them go,
yeah.
Which I still do when I catch a big amberjack out there. So it was pretty cool. It was pretty cool. So hopefully we will have some fishing stories by next week's show. I'm going to try to go out this weekend, whether it be for offshore or stay inshore, depending on the weather. I'll get some out there tomorrow. All right. As always, this show, you get to hear it a couple times over the weekend. So if you missed something, check it out. 11 o'clock on Saturday nights. You get it again on Sunday morning and Sunday evening. And the podcast available, too, through our website or our app or any of the podcast platforms out there. Check it out. All right. See you next week.
See you next week, Sean.